supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, we humans define ourselves based on our history. I mean, that's the building block for our identity, our history, or what we remember of it. But what if those memories are changeable, like puzzle pieces? New research is telling us that our recollection is influenced by who we're talking with, how we're feeling at the moment, and how we felt when the incident was actually happening. We think of our memories as solid facts, but every time we remember, there's evidence that we are actually rewriting our autobiography. Joining us to talk about memory is Charles Fernyhough. He's a professor of psychology at Durham University in the UK. He's joining us by telephone. He's also the author of several books, fiction and nonfiction, including 1,000 Days of Wonder, A Scientist's Chronicle of His Daughter's Developing Mind. He's also a contributor to NPR's Radio Lab, and he blogs for Psychology Today. Charles, welcome to the show.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me on.
It's so good to be with you. I've been reading your material for a long time now. I want to tell our listeners that our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We're talking about the nature of memory and the nature of memories today. Again, 888-477-9499. Charles, I love the opening of your book when you're having a discussion with your son about fishing, and he asks you if you remember the first fish you caught. What was your answer, and what was the process there?
Well, he really put me on the spot, didn't he? He asked me to come up with something that, you know, I quite possibly had never remembered, never brought to mind in my life. I mean, it was something that I had done. You know, I'd been talking to him about how I used to go fishing as a kid with my uncle. So I knew I'd done this stuff, but I'd never had cause to recall it. So it was a very interesting moment for me because it sort of brought to light all the fascinating qualities of recalling the past, that kind of sense of uncertainty, that kind of dizzy moment of, are you sure, are you not sure, what exactly is this that's forming in front of your mind's eye? And it just seemed like a good place to start.
You said you've never had to recall it. Do we have to recall something to hold it in memory? So if your son caught his first fish, and that could be a wonderful and important experience to him, and is it possible he could just hold on to that without being asked to recall it?
Well, that's one of the curious things about memory. What's the status of a memory that isn't currently in mind, a memory that we haven't recalled for a long time, or perhaps have never recalled? You'd probably be able to come up with events that you've never actually thought about since they happened, but you can still remember them. So what happens to those memories when they're not in our minds? And we're not really sure. One thing that the science seems to be pointing to is that those memories kind of break apart into their constituent components whilst they're not being recalled. And that when it becomes time to bring them back, when we're asked about the past, then we put things together again. We reconstruct the past according to lots of different bits of information. We stick it together into this interesting sort of multimedia collage, and that's what we call a memory.
Both of my grandfathers died when I was 4 years old, and I don't think I remember them at all, but I tell myself stories about them based on photographs and stories my parents told me, and I don't know what's real.
Well, that's very much my conclusion as well from thinking about memory for the last few years. And in Pieces of Light, one of the messages I wanted to get across is that we need to have a different relationship with our memories. very often we seem to be concerned about memory as a thing, as a possession that you've either got or you haven't got. And people want to know, how can I have more of this stuff? How can I have more of this stuff in my head? I think that's the wrong way of thinking about memory. I think if you think instead of it as a process of reconstructing the past, retelling the past, then the curiosities and the foibles of memory start to make much more sense, and we can enter into a much happier relationship with our memories. You know, so lots of people would say to me in relation to, when they heard about this book, they'd say, oh, I'm so depressed, I don't remember stuff anymore, it never sticks, my head is like a sieve, and so on. That's not true. They are, of course, remembering plenty of stuff. It is hard to function as a person if you have no memory at all, although people do manage in amazingly resourceful ways. But instead, if you can think of memory as something that you do, and that you keep doing, and that you keep redoing, and you do in collaboration with other people, and you do using all sorts of props and external devices and notes and records and, you know, pictures and movies and all that stuff.
So I talk often about behavior as being, most of our behavior is habitual. Most of our emotions are habitual reactions. Even our thoughts about things are habits. And you're saying memory is kind of the same way.
I think memories do have some qualities in common with habits. I think we tend to remember things a particular way. We get into routines of remembering a particular event or a particular set of events. We can change them, though. People can change them. Other people, through talking to us about them, can change the way we reconstruct the past. So they're not absolutely fixed, immutable habits, but there is a kind of familiar certainty about the way we make sense of our past. And, of course, in therapy, that's an incredibly powerful, but also can be a dangerous fact.
Powerful and changeable.
Exactly. Powerful, and it can be dangerous because people can get stuck and because memories can be suddenly reshaped.
I want to know when and how this starts. I told you my grandfather died when both of them when I was four, and I don't remember them at all. So I you know, my health is a bit unstable. And when my grandson was born, I just so wanted him to live past four or five in hopes that he would remember me. And now I've got another little boy in my life. He's kind of a psychological grandson to me. And he's five. And that stays in my head, Charles, is if I go, is he going to remember me, and what's he going to remember? So tell me about those young brains. A lot of your research is based on when you were studying your three-year-old daughter. You wrote about that in, I think, Baby in the Mirror?
Yeah, that was my book that was published in the States as A Thousand Days of Wonder. And in writing that book, I came across exactly this issue, because, in fact, any parent has had this. You spend time with a baby, you have a wonderful day with them, you take them to the park, you show them all these things, or, you know, maybe they're a bit crotchety and you have some difficult moments with them, but you would still do those things even if you're aware that the baby is not going to remember any of it. I mean, we know that we don't remember much of our early lives. We don't remember much further back than the age of three or four. You know, lots and lots of scientific evidence to support that view. But that doesn't mean that spending time with a baby is not really well worthwhile, because, A, the baby is learning all sorts of things that aren't necessarily going to be recalled as memories later, but they're still important. And, B, it's important to spend good time with another human being, whether or not they remember it all. So to allay your concerns, I would say, even if these little people don't have rich, detailed memories of you, the time you spend with them is still incredibly worthwhile. And that's what I mean about a different relationship with our memories. If we see memories as complex, changing, dynamic, shifting thing, rather than these are things in our head, you know, these are memories, these are possessions that we either have or we don't have, then we can stop beating ourselves up over what we do and don't remember, what others do and don't remember.
Oh, boy, would that be a gift? You know, I'm thinking, as you're talking about the valuable time spending with these young people, whether they remember me or not, I was thinking that, you know, I should have been paying rapt attention to what you were saying, but I was elsewhere and thinking, well, isn't that a bit narcissistic of me, wanting them to remember me? And what I really want them to remember was the experience of me, of being loved, of being held, of feeling the emotions of me, rather than the detail.
Sure, and the stories of you, the personality of you. And so when you talk about your memories of your, I think you said your grandfather, your own weak memories, yes, those memories are, if you like, affected, shaped, contaminated even by other stories that people have told you, pictures you've seen, maybe you've heard his voice on a tape, whatever, all these different kinds of information. But that's precisely the point. That's how memory works. All memories work like that. They're always being shaped, contaminated, changed by other bits of information that are floating around. So if you say that to yourself about those fragile memories and see them as just the kind of prime examples of that complex process of reconstruction that memory is, then I think we can be a bit easier on ourselves. I mean, here's another way of putting it. I describe in the book how my father died before my children were born. They never met him. They never had any time with him.
How old were you when he died?
I was 29 when he died.
Okay.
So my kids weren't born for... my daughter was born a couple of years later. So they knew nothing of him. But it became very important to me, exactly that question you've raised. I wanted them to know him. I wanted to find some way in which they could have some kind of handle on him. And I knew that would be partly about the things I told them, about the funny things that he used to do and say, and of course they'd see pictures and videotape and so on. But I kind of wanted to go further. I wanted them to actually remember him. So I did something which, on the face of it, might seem a bit ethically dubious. I talked to them, and I tried to sort of seed in them memories of him as a person, so that when they thought about him, they actually had effectively a false memory of him. Now, I'm interested to know what your listeners think of that. I would defend it by saying it's not a bad thing for children to know something about their family. But also, it's the kind of thing we're doing all the time. We're always shaping each other's memories. We're always having our own memories changed and contaminated and enhanced and embellished by other stuff that's going on. So there's nothing actually that unusual about giving somebody a false memory of somebody they never met.
Well, yeah, you're right. We do it all the time. In this case, you were giving your children, your truth about your father. So, you know, to me that's ethical. I've got no ethical problem with that. But what happens when a parent lies to a child about something that's happening and implants that kind of false memory? And I'm thinking of you know, a parent of an alcoholic spouse who lies to the child about what's going on, or you know, a parent of an unfaithful spouse who left the marriage and telling the child that their father died.
I can't answer that. That's an ethical question. That's a moral question that human beings have to make up their own minds about.
Well, I guess I'm asking it as a clinician. But
yeah.
You said in your book that the ethical implications of understanding memory may be more far-reaching than we could imagine.
Yes, I think so, because it changes the way that we accept testimony from other people about what has happened. If our memories are as fallible as they seem to be. I mean, we've always known they're fallible. People have been writing about the fallibility of memory for hundreds of years. You know, there's nothing new in that idea. I think the interesting thing for me is, in what way is memory fallible? And what does it tell us about how the mind constructs these amazing representations of the past? But, you know, so we know that memories are fallible, and that means that when somebody says something happened, you've got to have a different relationship to what they say. And, of course, in a legal context, this is incredibly important. We're seeing changes in the way that eyewitness testimony
is treated. It's really being devalued now in the States, eyewitness testimony.
Yeah, there have been big changes in New Jersey and New York, I believe. It's happening in the UK as well.
Why?
And, because eyewitness testimony has been shown to be so fallible that it's now more and more recognized that you need to have some other decent corroborating evidence before testimony can be accepted. And I think that's right, because that is what the science is telling us about how memory works. So that's one example of those sorts of ethical implications. And, of course, another example is the whole realm of memory enhancement and manipulation. You know, if it were possible to change one's own memories, change somebody else's memories, how would we deal with that? What would we do about it? How far would we go?
Yeah, well, I want to be careful here, Charles, because isn't that what I do for a living as a clinical psychologist?
Well, I'm really pleased to hear you say that.
Yeah.
And I think it's something, if we're honest, we all do. You know, we don't need the sort of sci-fi world of total recall to get a flavor for what memory manipulation is like. We're doing it all the time. I'm doing it with my kids. I'm telling them about their granddad, who they never even met. And I'm doing it in much more subtle ways with my kids in all sorts of, you know, even, for example, you go out for the day. You go to the lake or the park or whatever. One day you decide to take the video camera with you. The next day you don't. You're making a decision, conscious or unconscious, about what bits of that little person's life will be recorded and therefore will be easier to recall later. So we're doing it all the time. We're doing it with our colleagues and our spouses and our friends. We're constantly, consciously or unconsciously, manipulating other people's memories.
Well, Charles, we've got to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to talk to you about your interviews, your series of interviews with your 93-year-old grandmother. I want to go to the other side of the spectrum with you.
Sure.
We're listening to Charles Fernyhough, and he is a science writer, psychologist. His latest book is Pieces of Light, How the New Science of Memory Illuminates the Stories We Tell About Our Pasts, and it's now out in paperback. We'd love to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. That's 888-477-9499. We've got a couple of open lines. Tell us about your memories. Are they rigid? Have they changed? Can they change? Do you believe all this stuff? Give us a call. 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
Keystone Clinical Studies of Norristown is conducting a clinical research trial for adults who suffer from major depressive disorder. If you are between 18 and 65 suffering from major depressive disorder, and if your current medication is not working, you may be eligible to participate in this clinical research trial. Participants will receive investigational drug and study-related evaluations. 610-277-8073, 610-277-8073, or KeystoneClinicalStudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host, talking with science writer and psychologist Charles Fernyhough about the nature of memory and memories. Charles, let's go, before we talk about your grandmother, let's go right to the telephones here. We've got Mike on the line. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Dr. Dan. Thank you for taking my call, and as always, another incredibly thought-provoking show, so I thank you for that.
You.
And also thanks to Charles, your guest, for sharing his valuable information. As I'm listening to the program, something occurred to me, and I kind of formulated this idea of the priority of memory, meaning that why can some people remember certain things and others struggle with that same memory? I think we prioritize it very much. We're saturated with information, so we have to establish some sequence of priority. The other thing is, in your discussion about the fallibility of memory, I kind of on the surface disagree. I think the memory is incredibly efficient, and the efficiency of that is demonstrated in the fact that we're able to recall things as we choose to, depending on our current environmental or life circumstances. We may have had a parent that was partially good, partially abusive. If we need to remember that parent as a great parent, that's pretty much how we recall those memories. One other thing, and then I'll take comments off the air. Thank you. Your guest, Charles, brings up a very interesting thing. My father also passed away several years before my daughter was born. My daughter is incredibly inquisitive and always asks me about him, and I feed her exactly as Charles does, the information that I want her to have to formulate a certain opinion of her grandfather that works to her benefit.
And
thank you for your time, and I'll continue to listen,
Mike,
off the line.
Thanks so much. And I'm happy to report, Mike, that you called exactly the right number if you want information, because I happen to know somebody on the other side of the pond that has all this research and can address all of your questions. It's all yours, Charles.
They're really good questions.
Yeah.
I think one of the things I should have said at the start is that we need to be clear about what we mean by memory.
Mm.
Memory is a lot of different things. You know, any organism, any intelligent system has got to be able to store information about its past. And we do that. We do that in all sorts of different ways. We remember how to do stuff. We remember facts. We remember dates and numbers and all the rest of it. The kind of memory I'm talking about is the memory for the events of our own lives, those experiences, those re-experiencings of the past that allow us to be back in the moment and feel and look out through our own eyes and so on.
What
so
you've called that, our autobiography, right? Our autobiographical memories.
Yeah, we refer to this as autobiographical memory.
Okay.
So, and I wondered whether the first point related to other kinds of memory. So, for example, semantic memory, remembering facts, keeping track of, as you call the, as Mike pointed out, this flow, this endless stream of information that's coming in at us. You know, how do we remember all that stuff? Well, that's an interesting question, and people differ hugely in their ability to do that and also the kinds of techniques they use for remembering stuff. But it's not so much my focus. My focus is on how do I remember my first day at school? How do I recall my first radio interview, my wedding day, and so on? In relation to the second point, Mike is absolutely right that our memories do an amazing job. You know, we do not, although memory is fallible, we do not get the past wrong wholesale. We don't usually become totally confused or deluded about who we've been in the past. We do a pretty good job. But, of course, we get the details wrong, and we mix up bits of information that shouldn't be mixed up. And I think a really useful way of understanding that, and one that I really focused on in Pieces of Light, is to ask, what is memory for? What is this kind of memory for? And there's some fascinating new research which is suggesting that memory, this kind of memory, autobiographical memory, isn't for remembering the past from an evolutionary point of view.
Huh.
That's not what it's there for. It's there for the future. It's there to help us think about what's going to come next, because that's the evolutionary survival challenge. You know, what am I going to do? You know, forget what passed. I survived that. What I care about is how do I act when that situation arises again. So memory, on this view, is about using the information that's happened to us so that we can think, project ourselves forward into the future, imagine that situation arising again, and know what to do when it comes.
And that
explains a lot about the quirks of memory.
We did a show a couple of months ago, and one of the things our cognitive psychologist guest talked about was how our brain is like Velcro for negative events and Teflon for positive events. And this is why we hold on to the negative events, because that's what helps us predict our future. That's what helps us feel safe in the future.
Yeah, I think there's some truth in that you learn more when things go wrong. You learn from your mistakes, and that's what's going to help you to get through to the future. I don't think it's true that we don't remember positive events. I think particularly it depends on what age a person you're talking about, but in old age, we do tend to have a rather positive view of past events. There seems to be a bias towards positive events in old age.
Mm. There's research about how the body holds memories, and, you know, attending to that can help focus us. This is the work of, I don't know if you're familiar with him, Eugene Gendlin, an emotionally focused therapist. The body holds memories when the prefrontal cortex might not necessarily be able to.
Well, certainly our pasts shape us in all sorts of ways, and they don't necessarily shape us through the medium of explicit autobiographical memory, those memories, those representations of the past that are accessible to consciousness. Things that can happen can change us in other ways. So I mentioned interacting with a baby. You know, you can really mess a baby up if you treat it badly.
Mm-hmm.
But that baby isn't necessarily going to remember a single thing in terms of the kind of memory I'm talking about. So you're into slightly different territory, and it's a very, very complex picture, the way in which explicit and implicit memory systems seem to work side by side.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got several people who want to join us. Let's talk with David from Princeton. Hi, David.
Oh, hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if you guys could comment about the role of memory and guilt. Specifically, I feel like actions in my past that I've been guilty for are sort of seared in my brain with the specifics, the accuracy of it. Is that more the individual, or is that just an actual function of memory in non-psychopathic persons, I guess, and if any of the new research has shed light on that?
David, I want to clarify something or underline something you said mm-hmm. just now. You said mm-hmm. you've been guilty for things you've done in the past. Have you been guilty or felt guilty?
Oh, no, I'm just talking. I remember when I bullied a girl in second grade, and it was minor bullying, but I always feel bad about it. And every time a girl with that same name even enters my life, it's like the first thing I remember is that girl.
Hmm.
I always wish I could apologize to her, but I mean, I was only 8, 9 years old, and other sort of like white crimes, white lies, things that we know we do that are wrong, but we do it anyway, and then of course the guilt plagues us.
All right, let's don't go away. I want Charles to react, and then I want to react beyond just saying oy vey.
Well, one thing that we know about memory is that it's affected by the emotional context of the event. So emotional stuff is remembered better, whether it's positive or negative. That's just a pretty basic fact about memory. So I would say you can explain that observation by simply saying you felt something around those events, mm. and so they stuck in your mind. Things that left you cold, you're not going to remember. So that's a fairly basic fact. Another point about early memories is that they're often about humiliation. People's early memories often have this theme of being exposed in public or being laughed at. Again, it's something that for a child leads to very, very strong emotions. And so it's not surprising that those things stick in memory.
I want to, David, touch on something Charles talked about. And that was the affect, the emotion that you experienced then that you experience now. So let's, guilt is kind of something in your head. Tell me what it feels like when you think about that or see a name. What's the emotion you feel?
Well, I mean, I didn't say guilt and sorrow. I mean, I don't know if I could ever change anything. But, I mean, even not even just early childhood, but even, like, later, you know, if we lie on a form or something like that. I mean, this is a small little white lies that people occasionally might do. And we know we're doing wrong or something. And it seems like, for me, I remember the context where I was or where what I did wrong. And it sort of sticks with me. And I try to change it and not do things like that again. But
David,
I'm just stuck with how accurate those memories are.
David. You remember what you've done, but you're not remembering who you were and what you were experiencing at the time. You remember the behaviors, but not the person. It was an 8-year-old boy that you're not recalling, that you're not re-inhabiting his body. And you're not recalling the person that did all of these things. I urge you to please look up Kristen Neff, who writes a great deal about self-compassion. And what I'm hearing here is an absence of kindness towards you,
Mm-hmm.
Look up Kristen Neff, okay?
All right, thank you so much, guys.
Can I just add something to that as well? One of the things that we know about how memory works is that it is subject to all sorts of biases. And in particular, the memories we recall are very much shaped by who we are now, as well as who we were then. And I think that's your point, really, Kent.
Mm-hmm.
That the person who's recalling that event is the grown-up man thinking back. The person he is now is shaping and judging that earlier event. And we see that all the time in memory. You know, it's very hard to recall exactly how you felt about a historical event, for example, because things have changed about your feelings in the intervening time. People find it very hard to recall their political views from their early life because political views often change over life, and of course they get filtered through the lens of the now, the person that you are now, rather than the person you were back then.
David, I was molested by my teacher in seventh grade. I was 12 years old. And when that happened, I was, of course, ashamed and humiliated. I didn't tell anybody, and I felt that I did something wrong. I should not have gone to his house. I should have resisted him. I should have said something. I mean, you know how all that goes. And then years later, I forgot. I literally forgot, which is not unusual. And then about a decade later, I re-inhabited the body of that 12-year-old boy who laid there helpless and confused, and I just cried for him. And now all of a sudden, all of that feels so much better inside. I cried for that boy who suffered. And all of us do. All of us do with something in our lives, and we wind up judging ourselves. So I encourage you to read Kristen Neff and be kind. Just be kind. Charles, I said I wanted to talk to you about your grandmother, so tell us about her. You did a series of interviews with her. And when you did, I noticed you focused on subjective issues and small details to probe her memory.
Yeah, my grandmother was born in 1918 to Jewish immigrants to the East End of London, one from Lithuania, one from Russia, who arrived in the country unable to speak English. And my grandmother grew up in the East End, heavily Jewish-dominated area around Brick Lane in the East End of London. Went to school, learned to read and write. She, in fact, taught her mother how to read English. And I always thought, you know, this is such an interesting background. It's part of who I am. It's part of my heritage. I'd like to know more about it. So when my grandmother was getting on in years, I thought it would be great to talk to her and perhaps find out some stuff that I wasn't hearing through the usual family stories. So see if she would tell me anything she hadn't told other people. So I just sat down with her on several occasions, set a tape recorder running, and listened to what she had to say. And one of the chapters, the last chapter of the book, is an analysis of those interviews and the sorts of themes that I found emerging over the period of time that I was talking to her, and using it really as a way of illustrating what we know about memory in old age. I could have just launched in with a kind of textbook treatment of what we know, but it seemed a much more interesting thing for me to tell a story about this one particular wonderful person who meant a great deal to me. So that's what I did.
You interviewed her as a writer and a scientist, but you also interviewed her as a grandson who loves her. So clearly you were curious about the person and not just the mechanics of her memory. So given what you said earlier about memory as a social phenomenon, I wonder if that heartfelt curiosity changed the way she might actually recall some of her past.
I think so. And also, I mention in the book that there's something about the social context that I can't prove it, and I don't really have any science to point to, but my strong suspicion is that she was able to talk to me in a way that she wouldn't have talked to her children. She wouldn't have talked to my mother, for example, in quite the same way. She wouldn't have talked about the same sorts of things. And that's because I'm a different person, and memory is a social process, but it's also all about context. It's all about the particular context in which a memory is told. So it seemed to me that I might uncover stuff that she wouldn't have told my mother and therefore would have got passed down to me in that way. I'm not saying I was on the lookout for deep, dark family secrets. You know, that would have been interesting, but it didn't emerge. I wasn't looking out for that. There were certain things that I was just genuinely very interested in. I wanted to know what it was like to be a young Jewish immigrant growing up in the shadow of Nazism. I wanted to know what it was like to face if she, in fact, did, I wanted to know if there was discrimination and racism. But also, you know, my great-grandfather, my grandmother's father, used to sell Bibles on the street in Brick Lane. He used to have a stall selling Bibles. And I always thought, I want to know about this person, this guy who didn't speak any English, who would sell Bibles to passers-by outside the fish and chip shop. I just want to know about that period of time. Mm. And she was able to tell me quite a lot.
Well, I would love to have time for you to tell the whole story about what your grandmother remembered, what she didn't, but our readers are just going to have to read it in your book. So we've got to take a short break. When we come back, we've got more callers I want to talk with, and I want to talk about trauma and PTSD. We're talking with Charles Fernyhough, and that book I was talking about is called Pieces of Light: How the New Science of Memory Illuminates the Story We Tell About Our Pasts. We'll be back in just 60 seconds. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
Do you feel the need to check and recheck constantly? Are you a prisoner of certain rituals and compulsions? Keystone Clinical Studies in Norristown is conducting a research study of an investigational medication for treating obsessive-compulsive disorder, or OCD. If you're between 18 and 65 and have been diagnosed with OCD, you may be eligible to participate. 610-277-8073, 610-277-8073, or keystoneclinicalstudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking with Charles Fernyhough. He's a science writer, he's a novelist, and he's a psychologist. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Bonnie on the line. Hi, Bonnie.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Thank you for this program. This is my question. It does relate to something you have been talking about, but it's a little bit deeper, okay? When one has had experiences that were traumatic, that become memories, and then become consistently, they bring up consistent anxiety and become obsessive. And even though one has done therapy work on them and different processes of letting them go, what can a person do to diminish that process somehow?
Charles, I said before the break we were going to talk about PTSD. This seems like it could be one manifestation of it. Tell us.
Sure. It's a very interesting topic, and thank you for sharing your story with us, Bonnie. It's a very complicated issue, how memory works with trauma. As I mentioned earlier, you've got this interplay between systems of remembering that are explicit, in other words, conscious, and memory systems that are not accessible to consciousness. But having said that, my reading of the research suggested that memory works in the same pretty basic way, whether you're talking about benign, neutral events or highly emotional, highly damaging events. I mentioned already that memory is affected by the emotional quality of the events, and so stuff that is more emotional is remembered better for longer. But another point to make is that memory is reconstructive, memory is fallible, memory makes mistakes, and that applies to trauma memories as well. And all the research seems to point to that fact, that there isn't anything fundamentally different about how memory works in trauma. As far as my own researches were concerned, I wanted to illustrate what I'd found out about the research by telling a story, and the story I told in that case was of a truck driver who was involved in a terrible fatal accident and as a result had full-blown PTSD symptoms, and through therapy was ultimately able to not forget the events, because the goal of therapy in those cases is not to cause forgetting, but to cause a reevaluation of the events, so the events are experienced, the memories are experienced differently, and in a less threatening and negative way.
You're talking about something beyond a reevaluation, almost a re-experiencing. Yeah.
Well, in particular, the goal of the sort of therapy that he went through was to break the link between the event, the memory of the event, and the emotions around it.
Right.
To make the memory less emotional, less damaging.
What kind of therapy, Tra?
He had a course of EMDR, which is a technique which is rather mysterious. Nobody really knows how it works. Scientifically, many people have cast doubt on whether it can actually work, whether it is proven to work. But clinically, certainly the people I spoke to said they see it working.
Me too. And there is a lot of research about outcomes. Still nobody knows how it works, but they've been done some nice research on that, and it seems to be effective for PTSD.
Yeah, I'd say it's still controversial in terms of the outcome measures that you'd want to be published in a
sure.
research trial, for example. But leaving that aside, clinically, the feeling that I got was that people were saying this is effective, very effective for some people. And certainly, and I was only telling one story, the story of this truck driver, and he absolutely swore by it. He thinks this technique changed his life. But what really happened...
How can you find someone who is an expertise in this EMDR, who is just not just learning the process, but somebody who's an experienced professional person?
Let me answer that. Are you in the Philadelphia area? Okay. All right. So you can Google EMDR, and they're, you know, it's a national organization. They've got people in every city. You can find a practitioner. And I believe if it's like any other organization, to become a member, you have to have a certain level of experience. So I would do that, Google EMDR. And if we get more information, more detailed information about where to look locally and how to find them, we'll put them on our website. We wish you the best, and thanks so much for your call.
Yes, thank you very much.
I want to talk about this business of our autobiographies. I did a workshop once for memoir writers who want to write their autobiography. And, you know, I told them I started it by giving a 10-minute talk about my autobiography. So I talked about the traumas in my life and what happened between, and I went from trauma to trauma chronologically. And then I said to them, but I could have told that story in my life 12, 15 different ways, the drop of a hat. So why did I choose that story for you, and what did I want from you, and what did you want to hear? And it's consistent with what one of my teachers told me, that any time you put the word I down on paper, you're writing fiction.
Hmm. Well, that quality of memory is very, very evident. You know, when we tell a memory, we are really telling it. We are telling a story. We are narrativizing, we are pulling together different bits of information and sticking them into a shape that makes sense to us. It's very much tailored to our audience, as you say. And we are effectively creating fictions. That's not to say that we should mistrust all our memories. That's not true. That's not the case at all. But we should take our memories with a pinch of salt. We should say, you know, I know something about how my brain is telling me this stuff. You know, I can get some distance from this memory. I can approach this memory knowing something about how memory works. And that's what I mean about entering into a different, more positive, more productive relationship with our memories.
Well, cultures have memories too. And you know, I'm thinking of the Middle East. And, you know, every time I've been to Israel and then over to the West Bank, I keep hearing narrative, and we have to hear each other's narrative. We have to understand it and respect it. But narrative is a kind of cultural history, and is that suspect too?
Well, I think it is reconstructive in the same way that a person's autobiographical memory is. It is shaped with certain motivations behind it. It is reshaped, it is remade as events change. And something similar to what I said was I was trying to make go on with my kids in relation to my father, I think goes on at the cultural level as well. People will talk about events that happen to their culture, to their people, as though they actually happened to them. They feel ownership of an event, even if they weren't there. I mean, to give a trivial example, the old joke about Woodstock and how twice as many people remember Woodstock as were actually known to be there. But something similar is going on with those bigger political events, cultures' own memories, and they reshape memories in just the same way as individuals do.
So why aren't you in the Middle East kind of working things out for these folks on a scientific level?
I never got the call. But, you know, I think some awareness of how we reconstruct and we narrativize. And storytelling is always motivated. And our own personal storytelling is motivated. This is something that Freud saw, that when we talk about the past, we're telling it for a reason, because we want certain things, whether consciously or unconsciously. And I think the same thing happens with memory. Memory is emotional and it is motivated. And so is cultural memory.
We tell our story in part because we want something in return. We want our listener to know something about us that we believe they don't know.
Yeah, we want to construct, or we want to put across a view of the self, of the ego, if you like, that suits us now. I don't want to tell a story about who I was that is true to who I actually was then. I want it to fit with who I am now. We do that all the time. It's probably completely natural. It's a byproduct. It's a function of the way that memory evolved, I guess, and what it's there for from a kind of biological point of view.
I'm curious about something, and we've just got a few sentences. You told your children about your father. Do you remember him differently after telling them those stories?
Well, if you follow the logic of what I've said, I guess I probably do. I hadn't really thought of that, actually.
Yeah.
You know, that process of trying to portray a particular person to him may well have shaped the way I now recall him. No. I don't know. I think I certainly tried to be even-handed. You know, my dad had his failings as well, so... And I certainly hope I was able to talk about them as well as his good bits.
That's to talk about your father, yourself, and your children is a nice way to conclude. I want to thank you so much for joining us, Charles.
Thank you, Dan. It's been great fun to be on the show.
Yeah, me too. We've been talking about the nature of our changing memories, autobiography, with science writer and psychologist Charles Fernyhough. To download our podcast, we're at whyy.org/voices, or you can get it on my webpage. We're at Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. And hey, check out my new webpage at drdangottlieb.com. It's brand new. There's more information on there, and I'm going to be starting a blog. That's drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Mr. Al Banks. Thank you, Al. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn produced today's show. You may have heard she's going to be spending time at WHYY's Morning Edition host for the time being. She's asked me not to say goodbye to her, but to say good luck, because she'll need it doing all those early mornings. And I want you to know, Jennifer wrote that. Jennifer, I love you. I'm going to miss you. You are fabulous. Thank you so much for everything you do and everything you've done to make this show great. So there, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Please enjoy your week, my friends.
You're a nap.